couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Beast, Orphan First Kill, Spin Me Round, She-Hulk, Attorney at Law, and Star Trek the Animated Series. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring the 1940s serial Terry and the Pirates. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first thing I want to talk about, it's not exactly news, but it's more about a debate that's going on. And we're seeing it actually happen, not just in this one very specific aspect I'm going to address, but we're seeing it happen as Warner Brothers is dismantling a lot of things in its HBO Max. The debate is about whether you should release something to streaming or whether you release something to theaters. And it stems from the fact that people really enjoyed Prey. I mean, not just the critics. Audiences have really liked it too. Hulu came out and announced that Prey was watched more times in that first week than any other debut of anything, whether it was a TV show or a movie or a rebroadcast. And that led a lot of people to say, well, why didn't you release it in theaters? Doggone it. You could have made so much money. You left money on the table. Well, first of all, there's a lot more to it than just a yes or no binary question of should it be in theaters or should it be online. Prey was part of 20th Century Fox, and then you had the Disney acquisition. This is what you do with business. When you consolidate assets, you have to decide what to do. And they were contractually obligated to certain things that we're not even aware of. And especially if you look at what happened with Black Widow, when that was put partly on Disney Plus and charged a premium, Scarlett Johansson rightfully sued and won over what she should have been due box office receipts, because they made money on that initial release, but they didn't necessarily pay her from those. It's usually not about art or content. It's about the money. And that's how these decisions are made. And sometimes the money decision is arbitrarily up the line, having nothing to do with the content. It just happens to be on the branch that's getting cut. But it also begs the question, would Prey have done better in theaters? Well, nobody knows. That's the reality. Nobody has any idea. There's no way you can get that data, because there's a lot of people who will watch stuff if it's available, which is why when you look at the top 10 on Netflix, sometimes it's crappy movies that came and went 10 years ago, because nobody cared to pay for them, but if it's part of their subscription, they'll watch it. But how many people would have actually paid good money to watch The Tiger King on Netflix versus, hey, you had a whole bunch of episodes on it during a pandemic and I need something to watch? So nobody knows if Prey would have done great in the theaters. It might have done okay, or it might have been another disappointing Predator movie. And you're seeing sort of the two sides of it happening, with Disney to a lesser degree, also like Paramount Plus and Peacock, which are releasing movies directly to their streaming service as well. And then on the other side of the coin, you've got Warner Brothers restructuring and literally pulling content off of HBO Max. Now, one of the things that happened this week with HBO Max is they started pulling content that was like animated stuff, the Max originals, the shows that were not generating a ton of buzz. But they took it off. And at first I thought, well, if nobody's watching it, who's to care whether they took it off? But the word is, the reason they're taking it off the streaming service is it reduces the financial burden of having to pay out royalties for the actors and the directors and the creators of those programs. And if nobody watches it, they don't have to pay anything, which I get that from a bottom line perspective, but that's kind of horrible to do to your creators. If you're making a show and there's people who want to watch it, why not let people watch it? I totally get it if nobody's watching it, but that's the financial games that Warner Brothers is allegedly playing. And one of the things that Disney does exceptionally well is it only puts on Disney content. Only the stuff that it owns goes on Disney Plus. That's the big difference between Disney Plus and Netflix is Netflix has their original content, which they're trying to beef up. And, you know, every couple months, people are like, well, I don't think we should have Netflix. Oh, look, another episode of Stranger Things. For years, Netflix has been trying to beef up its original content so it doesn't have to rely on something like its Seinfeld subscription. Whereas HBO Max is now trying to cut things back. And then I think at the same time, they want to be everything to everyone. I still think that the HBO Max game plan, which isn't much of a game plan, it's just some scratches on paper. I still think it's utter chaos over there. Whereas Disney has a streamlined specific process. But I like the idea of if you want to watch a Disney property, you're going to watch Disney. Now, of course, there's a lot of stuff that's not on there. There's old. I don't think you can get the Computer Wore Tennis Shoes. I know for a fact you can't get Song of the South. But that's been buried for years for different reasons. And there's a lot of classic programming that's never been put on Disney Plus, but it's not that they took it off. It's just they've never put it on there. And Disney has always played that game with pulling stuff on and off of disc, but you're not going to be able to watch anything outside of what Disney owns. So would Prey have done better in a theatrical release? I don't know. But I like the fact that it's available at home. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Tim Burton's new series on Netflix. Both of these are from Netflix, and I know I've been talking about Netflix a lot, but hey, this is where the interesting stuff showed up this week. And that show is Wednesday, which is coming to Netflix sometime this fall.
People like Dalton shouldn't be allowed to procreate. Getting expelled was just a bonus.
You will love Nevermore. It's a magical place.
Where I met your mother.
The son I love.
Finally, you will be among peers who understand you. Maybe you'll even make some friends.
Want to take a stab at being social? I do like stabbing.
This is a reboot of the Addams Family told from Wednesday's perspective. Now, what's weird about it is as good as the show looks and as dark and as twisted as it looks, it doesn't look 100% Tim Burton-esque. And that's okay, because I'm not looking for a cookie-cutter Tim Burton series. I want something that maybe is dark, but it doesn't necessarily look like it's the Dark Shadows remake he did. The thing that I find interesting is they haven't released an actual date. They just said fall. And I think part of the reason why they're dragging their feet on this is they got to figure out how this works in with releasing The Munsters, the Rob Zombie movie that apparently is going to be going to Netflix this fall as well. Are they going to put them close together and release? Are they going to somehow tie them together? At least in terms of some sort of Halloween holiday programming, or are they trying to differentiate them as well? Because they look like they're very different properties, and it could have good and bad things happening either direction. The next one I want to hit is Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosity, which comes to Netflix on October 25th.
Cabinet of Curiosities is a show that I've always wanted to make. In this anthology, we gave ownership of each episode to the directors. Each of the episodes has a whole world. They present you with different delights. Some are savory, some are sweet. You get a surprise. The world is beautiful and horrible. At exactly the same time.
I'm really looking forward to this one. I love anthology programming. I love horror movies. You know, going back to the... Well, I mean, Creepshow wasn't the first, but it was really the first one I saw. But you can go back to some of the Amicus horror movies from the 70s and even the 60s. There's some great stuff out there in terms of horror movie anthologies. And I love Guillermo del Toro's vision and his ability to cultivate young talent or new talent or at least different talent. I wouldn't exactly say Catherine Hardwicke, who's one of the directors of this, is a new talent. But I'm looking forward to this one simply because I love the idea that he's helping to do a horror anthology television series with practical effects and practical monsters. This looks like it's going to be kind of cool. So yeah, definitely looking forward to it. There's going to be some great stuff coming for Halloween season. Get your pumpkin spice lattes ready and your orange sweaters because I'm going to have a lot of fun as we roll into Halloween. And with that, next up on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about a horror film coming up, which is Orphan First Kill, as well as Spin Me Round. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Orphan First Kill. Before she terrorized her adoptive family, a psychotic woman poses as another family's missing child.
Welcome home, Esther. We left it just as it was.
It's lovely to be back. I miss my family very much.
I think something's going on with Esther.
Is there anything you want to tell me about your time away?
How's that possible? 4 years ago, she was still drawing stick figures.
Esther's behavior has been so erratic.
If you're not Esther, who are you?
This is in theaters, but it's also on Paramount+. This is one of those hybrid releases, and I have a feeling they're going to be leaning into this with horror movies because the last big one I really remember, even though it was a bit of a flop, was Firestarter earlier this year that went to Peacock. And horror movies tend to not have legs, especially, you know, late in the summer. I mean, it's not uncommon to release horror movies in August, but they tend to burn themselves out pretty quickly, especially once you get into October. Everyone wants to watch horror movie content in October, but once November hits, everyone's skipped on and moved up to Christmas. Now, this is a sequel to the 2009 movie Orphan. That was 13 years ago. And I remember I went back and I looked at my review of that, and I hated that movie. One of my biggest problems is that it was clear that there was something crazy going on in the film, and everyone seemed terrified of what was happening, but nobody actually seemed to address it. I just felt that there was some character moments. Now, it's been years since I've seen Orphan. I might like it better if I went back and revisited it. What's interesting is this new movie, I was kind of like, well, I'll watch it. I requested a screener, got the screener, and I was watching it. I'm like, okay, because the whole thing is in this one, you know that this is just a psychotic woman. It's actually based on a true story. There was a woman in Eastern Europe who posed as a family's child. I mean, it's one of those truth is stranger than fiction stories. But now that we have that out there, that's a known factor. You can't just make that your big twist in the movie. So they started off as being a prequel to that film where this psychotic woman poses as this family's missing daughter. And it's somewhat routine. I like the cinematography of it. It has that creepy cold weather cinematography. And I don't know if that makes sense to people, but that's always kind of a neat feeling to have in a horror movie, especially this time of year where it's blazing hot all over the place. I love that cool weather feel because horror feels very fall-like. And this one leans into it, even though it leans even more into being a wintertime film. So I was watching it, and I thought it was okay. It wasn't terrible, but then it, about halfway through, some things happen, and they do some interesting writing tricks that I got sucked in. I was like, ooh, okay, that's kind of cool. Oh, let's see what goes on here. Ooh, that's an interesting setup. Let's see how that plays out. And I just thought it was a much better written movie because the original movie just had it hinging on that one big surprise. And as interesting as that surprise was, you know, the twist being it was really a full-grown woman and not a child, they waited too long to actually give you that, and then it kind of turned on its ear already. But Orphan First Kill doesn't just give you the automatic story that you would expect from a movie like this. So I enjoyed it. I thought it was really a neat movie. I mean, it's not great. It's for horror fans. But especially if you like the first Orphan, this one has a neat little story to it as well. I gotta say, you know, I mean, that was quite silly as horror movies go. The cast's commitment to the roles, including Julia Stiles as the mom, and some neat story moments make this one surprisingly entertaining. I'm gonna have to say Orphan First Kill kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Spin Me Round. Allison Brie plays a restaurant manager who is taken to Italy for her job only to discover a substandard education program and bizarre personalities in the company.
Tuscan Growth has a program where they take all the top managers to Italy. Amber, pack your bags.
What?
You're going to Italy.
Benvenuta, signorina.
Ciao.
Welcome, everyone. I would like to introduce our CEO, Nick Martucci.
Ciao, amici.
This is my assistant, Kat.
I'm excited to get to know you a little better.
Listen, I think something weird might be going on.
First of all, this movie seems to have an axe to grind with the Olive Garden. And I know the Olive Garden is middle-class suburbanite Italian food that you think is classy but really isn't. I mean, I've been to really nice Italian restaurants. The Olive Garden isn't one of them. Don't get me wrong. I'll go to the Olive Garden. I will eat the Olive Garden salad. I will eat the breadsticks. I'll get the never-ending pasta. But I am not kidding myself into thinking that the Olive Garden experience is a true Tuscan Italian experience. I realize it's corporatized Italian food, you know, but this one really seems to have an axe to grind with it. And I'm assuming this is taking aim at Olive Garden because the setup feels very Olive Garden-ish. It's just they're not going to make an Olive Garden because, of course, Olive Garden wouldn't want to lend their name to it. I've said that name, I think, enough in this to get the idea. But I remember hearing several years ago, because there was an ad that was running that at that restaurant, they would bring all their chefs out to learn how to make the Tuscan food from the Italian chefs. And they would have this program where the managers and the chefs would go overseas. And there was a little write-up on it somewhere on the internet, and it wasn't as impressive as it sounds like in the ad. And that's kind of what happens with Alison Brie's character. She goes there and she finds that they're restricted to a location. The location isn't very great. It's just a crappy motel they're staying at. They're not staying in some Italian villa overlooking the Mediterranean or anything like that. It's just like a Hampton Inn somewhere, only in Italy. And they don't let them off the premises, and they teach them some stuff, but it's kind of a relatively rudimentary kitchen. And even though the person who runs the show, the guy who runs the restaurant, he comes out and he's charming and everything, he's kind of weird, and it appears that he's just out there to try and bed some of the women who are on the trip. And, you know, he's kind of like this rich kid who doesn't know anything and is kind of stunted emotionally. So her bubble is burst. I guess that's the story. It's also the story of her sort of realizing this. And I wouldn't even call it like an awakening story, because the stuff that happens is just so haphazard and bizarre, but not bizarre enough. It's like they have these ideas and they eventually take them to fruition. But it takes them so long to get there, you're like, oh, okay, finally you're doing the weird stuff. I mean, we've all been on trips, or even if it's just a day trip or some sort of field trip your work takes. And there's I'm not going to say the name of it, but there's a chocolatier in the town where I grew up. And you can tour their facility, and we toured their facility, and it was kind of, you know, disappointing. You're just like, okay, yeah, that's where they make chocolate. But you thought it'd be like, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but no, it's just a conveyor belt. You know, and so I've been on things that don't live up to what the hype is, but that's kind of what this is. And I'm like, I don't really know what the punch of the story is supposed to be. It's just some markedly bizarre things that have happened, but not so bizarre that they would even make a good book. So everything just seems like either the punches are pulled or there is no weight behind the punches. And the strange thing is, it's got a great cast. I mean, Alison Brie's great in it. Aubrey Plaza's in it. Zach Woods is in it. There's some good names associated with this. It just doesn't have any focus. And even at the end, it just keeps going. I'm like, well, you know, you get back to America and I'm like, is this over? Oh, I guess not. Nope. They still have some more stuff to not have happen. So yeah, the idea is an okay idea, but it seems like it was written down on Olive Garden napkins. So this is one of those overly ambitious ideas that never reaches even close to what the quality cast promises. I'm going to have to say that Spin Me Round kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, we've got Beast and She-Hulk, Attorney at Law. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Beast. Idris Elba plays a father who is pitted against a rogue lion to save his daughters in the African wilderness.
I've never seen anything like this. Multiple attacks without eating its prey. Lions don't do that. At least no lion I've ever seen. Go back to the calls.
Dad, please!
I've got to get my girls out of here. I need you to trust me right now.
This is man versus nature. You know, Jaws was man versus nature. You know, there's a giant shark that they're trying to stop and capture. The movie Grizzly is man versus nature, if you remember that movie from the 70s. We also had the movie Crawl a couple years ago. That's the one about the girl stuck in the Florida hurricane with alligators in her house. You know, the Anaconda movies. So basically that's what Beast is. Beast is a setup where you throw a couple people in a car in a safari and there's a rogue lion that's just killing people because it's mad because poachers killed its pride. And those elements are great. I mean, the lion effects are good. And they're, it's CGI. It's going to be CGI, people. What do you expect? For crying out loud. We'll talk more about this with She-Hulk. But you know what it would take to achieve the shots that they have and the integration of these shots if you used a real lion? You would probably have exhausted lions. You'd have a lot of danger on set. You really couldn't do some of the shots that you want to do. So you'd either have to augment them with CGI, or you might be dealing with people wanting to abuse the animal to get it to do stuff. And it's a CGI. It's a giant lion. Who cares? It's a lion. Just enjoy it. That's what the movies. I mean, when you saw Jaws, honestly, when you saw Jaws for the first time, did the shark really look real? It looked real enough. That's the whole point. The shark in Jaws looks real enough. And yeah, I'm the one who, I hate obnoxious CGI. I don't like to see blood splatters on the camera. I think that's a huge cliche. But, you know, if you're going to have a lion attacking people, yeah, use a CGI lion. That's probably a smart move. And those scenes are best. The best parts are the lion scenes. The big problems I had with this movie is, I mean, Idris Elba's okay. It's weird. He's kind of this mixed bag of the intellectual and the guy who thinks with his fists. Because he's a doctor. But he also is quick to grab a weapon. On top of it, his daughters are with him. And I got to a point where I was rooting against one of them. Because she was so annoying. And I know she's supposed to be like 15 and argumentative and her mother's dead from cancer. And so she's upset about that. And she's got all this baggage. But there are times where she just does stupid things. Whereas, like, if I were there with my kids, I don't care how misbehaved my kids are. I'm like, hey, look, there's a rogue lion out there. Let's not wander off. I went to the Columbus Zoo this summer, and they have this exhibit where the lions will lay right next to the glass, and you can sit, like, right next to them. And so I went up close. The lion was sleeping. I didn't wake it up or anything, but you could see how huge their paws are. And you can see how huge their teeth are. You don't realize how big these animals are until you put your hand up against its own paw. So there needs to be a healthy respect for it. Because people are like, oh, it's just a lion. Like, there's a scene, and it's in the trailer, where he punches the lion in the face. And I'm like, okay, that's seriously. So those things are a bit silly. But it still fits the bill for what it's trying to do. The biggest problem is just some of the writing is a little bit rough, but you don't need great writing for this kind of movie, for that sort of late summer monster flick. I mean, you know, Beast hits the mark, you know, if you need an escapist Jaws of the Jungle, but it does suffer from some character issues and a level of absurdity. I can forgive all that, though. I still think that Beast kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about She-Hulk, Attorney at Law. Bruce Banner's cousin Jennifer is infected with his blood and develops hulking abilities while trying to maintain a job as a lawyer.
Your transformations are triggered by anger and fear.
Those are like the baseline of any woman just existing.
I just want to be a normal, anonymous lawyer.
Can you tell us where She-Hulk is?
Jen, you're a story now.
You could be an Avenger.
Oh, I'm not a superhero. That is for billionaires and narcissists and adult orphans for some reason.
All right, this is interesting because it's a very polarizing show. And a lot of it isn't even the show's fault. I mean, I'm not going to bury the lead here. I enjoyed this show. I found it fun. It's a comedy. It's a sitcom, really. It's not meant to be a big action movie. And that's why you can watch an entire episode and there's really not a whole lot of action. And there's some special effects. Again, there's CGI, and I've heard a lot of people complain, this crappy CGI, the Hulks look stupid. Of course they look fake. They're Hulks. They've been doing CGI Hulks for 20 years. And there is not a single shot of any Hulk in any of the movies that they've made that looks real because he's a giant green rage monster. And she is a giant green rage monster. They're not going to look real. You absolutely know the Hulk is a cartoon character. The expectations and arrogance of the viewers today watching stuff. Again, going back to the original Incredible Hulk from TV, did Lou Ferrigno really look like he was a hulked out version of Bill Bixby? No. There are literally scenes in that show where you can see the Hulk wearing slippers so that he could run through dirt and gravel and twigs without cutting up his feet. But just because, oh, CGI is supposed to be able to do anything, who cares? It's a comedy. It just needs to look good enough. I don't think you need thousands and thousands of thousands of extra man hours just to make the Hulk look just as good as possible. Because I want it to be perfect. It has to be exactly what I think of in my brain. The other thing that's happening is they're trying to diversify the stories that they're telling in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They're not just trying to tell big superhero movies. They're not trying to tell some galactic threat where a city gets destroyed every movie. Because that gets boring. That's kind of what makes Marvel so good, is they keep changing things up. So you're going to get some comedy. So I love the fact that they're leaning into comedy. That's what I liked about the Thor movies. Not everything has to be straightforward, and not everything has to be told even from a human perspective. But that anytime there's any sort of character that is not the white guy in a super suit, suddenly everyone's like, it's woke. It's too woke. Is Marvel too woke? No, Marvel's not too, cause look, if She-Hulk makes Marvel woke, She-Hulk's been around since the early 80s. And you want to take it up with somebody, dig up the corpse of Stan Lee, who created the character in 1980. This character's 40 some years old. So is it woke? No, it's not. It's just that this is kind of what She-Hulk was, as I understand. I never read that comic in particular, but as I understand it, this is kind of the way She-Hulk was. It was a little bit more whimsical. It wasn't the heavy emotional, I hate myself, I just wish I wouldn't be a rage monster level that you had with the Hulk stories. So it's basically like Ally McBeal if one of the lawyers would turn into a big green monster in the courtroom. It's funny. It's meant to be silly. It's about a woman in her 30s navigating life. It's just she also happens to be a Hulk. And yeah, I've only seen the first 4 episodes of it. Because that's all that they gave the press. But I enjoyed it. I think it's funny. It's whimsical, and it's not meant to be this giant action movie from beginning to end. And that's okay. It doesn't have to be. Not everything from Marvel has to be the same thing that you got from every single movie. Not everything has to be Iron Man. Like, I rarely read reviews, but I was reading one of the reviews, and this person was complaining. First of all, it's clear that this person was complaining about all the Marvel movies that have come out in the last 4 years. And then he was complaining about, oh, well, if you have a hyphenated superhero name, they're all terrible. Yeah, you know, like Spider-Man. And then he's complaining because it's not like Fleabag. It's not the brilliance of Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Fleabag. And I'm like, I've watched Fleabag. I don't want She-Hulk to be Fleabag. Fleabag has a really dark tinge to it. The only reason this guy was connecting it to Fleabag was because it's a show about a woman in her 30s. I enjoyed She-Hulk. I think they're funny stories. I think they have whimsical characters. It's something that you can watch and not have to be so emotionally invested that you're exhausted. Now, while this one can be polarizing for some, it's a fresh foray into entertaining sitcom territory for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I approve. I'm going to say She-Hulk, Attorney at Law, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the Star Trek animated series from the 70s and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Terry and the Pirates. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Recently, I've been catching up on a bunch of Star Trek stuff. I watched the original series when I was a kid, as most people did in reruns. And I watched a good chunk of The Next Generation when I was in college. I watched some of the other shows, but you know they did so many. I've only seen a smattering of Deep Space Nine and Voyager, and I hadn't seen anything of Enterprise. But something I knew existed was the Star Trek animated series from the early 70s. Now, I finished watching the original series. I went and I watched it straight through because I hadn't seen all of it. I think there were 1 or 2 episodes I'd never seen just because I was always catching them when it was on reruns. But then I always heard that the 4th season of Star Trek was sort of considered by fans to be this animated series. That's not exactly how it worked out, but soon after the cancellation of the original series, they decided to do this animated series. And that's Star Trek, the animated series. It ran in 1973 and 1974. It's done by Filmation, and it was a Saturday morning cartoon. That's also my wheelhouse. I grew up watching these things. I never watched this as a kid. I may have watched one or two episodes over my time, but I was maybe a little bit later, like late 70s was when I was really watching a lot of Saturday morning cartoons. But anyways, the Star Trek animated series, this continuation of the original Star Trek series in half-hour animated form, sees new discoveries for the crew of the Enterprise.
Captain's log, stardate 5221.3. On outward course beyond the fringe of our galaxy towards Questar M17.
It's a starship. Nothing I've ever seen. The size of it. Captain, something's beamed aboard with you.
Captain, decks 5 and 6 report shutdown of all life support systems.
All non-essential systems are extinguished. You will obey me.
And if I refuse...
That's kind of a crappy trailer. There's only so much available out there. I think that was done by a Star Trek fan out there somewhere. But the thing that I think is most impressive is they bring back most of the returning voices. You, of course, have, you know, Shatner and Nimoy and Kelly doing the voices of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. But you also brought back James Doohan to do Scotty and George Takei. And I think Nichelle Nichols and... Michelle Barrett were also on there doing stuff. And then a lot of them doubled, like James Doohan does a lot of the voices on it. And if you're watching it, you'd be like, oh yeah, no, that sounds a little bit like Nichelle Nichols. The thing that's interesting about this is it was done with real stories that were written by some of the same people that were involved in the original series. Some of the same names, like DC Fontana was showing up in the credits. So, the stories were very much in line with the original series. Now, they're shorter. They were half-hour episodes. And they have a little bit more simplistic of the stories because it was animated. And they were limited by animation. You can see a lot of scenes where they'll repeat a lot of the same cell animation because it was cheaply made. That's kind of how Filmation was back then. But I have to say, watching this series, it was impressive to me how... similar to the original series it was. I mean, it didn't have the character moments. It stripped a lot of the character stuff out for the sci-fi elements. And some of it was a little simplified, but not much. Actually, I understand now why Trekkers look at this as season 4 of the series, because it plays that way. It flows in there, and I appreciated it. So if you haven't had a chance to see it, it's available on Paramount Plus. It was on Netflix for a while, but I think they've moved it in the consolidation of properties. You know, even though it was produced for Saturday morning kids consumption, it retains an impressive amount of the original series vision. I think there's like something like 16 or 20 episodes. It's worth checking out. So I'm going to have to say Star Trek the Animated Series rocks. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's feature is found on Tubi, and that is Terry and the Pirates. Let's just go ahead and play this trailer, and I'll talk a little bit more about it. This 15-chapter serial, based on Milton Caniff's classic comic strip, follows an annoying teenager searching for his kidnapped father in the mysterious jungle.
You think Dad'll be sore at me for coming along?
It's a little late to worry about it now, Terry. You know, your Dad'll be so happy to see you, he won't think about bawling you out until later.
Come on, man. Come on, give us a hand here.
Gee Williker, what do you suppose it means?
Whatever it means, we'll pay no attention to it. We're headed for Wing Fu.
Now, to most people in this day and age, nobody knows who Terry and the Pirates are. But it was back in the day when newspaper comic strips, you had serialized content. The Phantom was another one that was in the newspapers. They would have, you know, these three panels, four panel stories, and each day they'd continue the story. And it wasn't like a joke. I mean, it wasn't like Peanuts where it was a gag. It was continuing the story one strip at a time, which seems like just a difficult way to read something. But that's kind of how things were done back then, early part of the 20th century. And Terry and the Pirates were, it was based in an adventure series, and they, you know, they made it into a jungle adventure for the serial, but Terry and the Pirates is a lot more of it. They're dealing with spies and bad guys and international intrigue. It wasn't just people running around a jungle. So it was very, very popular. And like I said, nobody knows about it now, but it was very popular. And then in the 50s, they did a TV series of it. But in 1940, they did a serial. Now, if you don't know anything about these movie serials, they were super cheap productions that the studios did to fill content before the movies. You know, they'd have the movie and they'd usually just have it keep running. And they'd have like trailers and newsreels and that sort of thing run before the feature. And you have these serials that would be sometimes 15, 20 minutes long, just little short stories. And that's originally what Star Wars was trying to evoke with, you know, sort of like episode 4. And Lucas always talked about Star Wars. The reason he started with episode 4 was he wanted people to kind of have to just jump into the middle of it and figure it out, which is what happened with these serials. You never got a chance to choose which episode you saw. You just went to the theater and whatever one that they had gotten sent by the studio is what you saw. And you'd sometimes, you know, maybe just see 5 episodes and they all came from the end of it. Who knows? The word is that Milton Caniff, when he saw this, he was shown this first episode, at least, and he stormed out because he thought that they ruined it, because they kind of do. This is a terrible story. I mean, it's got everything that's wrong with movie making from the 40s. And got to remember, this is cheap, low budget stuff. Nobody spent really any money on this. And all these serials, there's a ton of them. You'll find a ton on YouTube. And I suggest they're fun to watch. Now, what's interesting is some of them, they've done like bigger names. Like there's a Batman serial out there. There are actually 2 of them. One of them you can't find anywhere because the bad guys were the Japanese and there's all this racist language in there. But the original Batman serial, this might be the second one, actually riffed all 15 serials. So you can find all 15 episodes. You can find those on the Rifftrack site. And they're now doing a Shazam riff tracks for this new serial. So I'm going to have to probably start getting those. I wish that they would do Terry and the Pirates, because Terry and the Pirates is off the chain. It's ridiculous. It's everything that's goofy and silly. It's everything about a jungle adventure that is ridiculous. You know, you've got, the sort of yellow faced villain. You have this bad guy. His name's Fang. He's a half caste and he literally, I can't even do the accent. I'd get kicked off the radio, but that's how he talks. And it was this character that convinced me that George Lucas, as much as he talked about Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, that this was the serial he based Star Wars on. Because, I mean, you watched episode 1 with the Trade Federation, and it was absolutely these yellow-faced characters. And in the story, Terry is this annoying, whiny, teenage blonde kid, and he's hanging out with Pat, who's this older, dark-haired swashbuckler. And they have to go save the daughter of one of the scientists who's held by the bad guys in their lair. They have these 2 guys that help them out that are, one's really tall, one's really short, and they're sort of their sidekicks. The bad guys run around in black and white uniforms. I mean, there's so much stuff that you sit there and you look at it and you go, this is absolutely Star Wars. And there's even an element when they fall into, in one of the later episodes, they fall into a pit that's like the walls start closing in. I mean, it's literally that scene from Star Wars. And I've never heard George Lucas acknowledge this, but I swear to God, you should watch it. It's in the public domain. You can find it a lot of places. You can find it on Tubi. Tubi's probably the easiest to do. I know the Internet Archive has it. Terry and the Pirates is a scream. I mean, it's infinitely riff-worthy and dripping with uncomfortable historical Hollywood racism. This thing is simultaneously cringeworthy and laugh-out-loud hilarious. Boy, is it a lot of fun. So I'm going to have to say Terry and the Pirates, for all of its warts, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Available on disc this week, we have Jurassic World Dominion and The Black Phone. And that's it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Funny Pages, Breaking, and Maneater. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.